Welcome to Conservation Connection, the show where we do that each week, connect you to people in the field of conservation. I'm Chance.
And I'm Sarah Catherine.
And this week, we're actually recording this intro from the beach.
We love the beach so much.
And this is a beach that you've been coming to, like, your whole life.
Yeah, this is definitely the beach, like, where I grew up, coming on family vacations. I always credit Cape San Blas, where we are in Florida, as like the place that was really formative for me, I guess, in like loving the environment and especially the ocean for me. Like, I am a big ocean person, love dolphins, whales, turtles, all of that stuff, especially when I was younger. And I think is a big part of the reason, you know, that I wanted to get into this field of conservation and be working and interacting with animals in any capacity I could be. So I owe a lot of that to my grandmother, who's passed away now, Kathy, but we would come down here like literally since before I could remember. So it's a great place and we love to be here.
So we came down here, you know, just to get to spend some time in the nature that we love so much. I think that's super important, carving out time to be in nature. It definitely recharges me. I know it recharges you, especially being by the water. I did want to take a minute before we kind of go further into this week's episode to answer the question that we had come in on our Spotify app. So if you guys don't use the Spotify app, we post polls and questions that you guys can respond to. Like last week, we posted the question, what would you rather be, a rattlesnake or a gopher tortoise? Personal, my answer is rattlesnake, but the majority of people, both on Instagram and on our Spotify poll, said gopher tortoise, which is a little surprising to me, but you know, it's fine. People can make whatever wrong choices they want to make.
You know, I've said this a few times on the podcast. I just really love a gopher tortoise. I didn't find out about them until a few years ago, and I just think they're amazing. However, rattlesnakes are kind of always ready for a party. So
they've got those built-in maracas right there. Just tick, tick,
tick, tick, tick. Yeah, I'm surprised more people didn't go for that. So anyway.
Yep. But we did get a really fun question. So the question that came in is like, we've talked about ticks for two episodes in a row now. And what's the deal with ticks? Why are they helpful? Why do they matter in the environment? Like, would it be okay if they all disappeared in a fire? Really, the value of ticks boils down to a couple of things. One is that they represent one of the very few places where energy in an ecosystem can go from kind of the larger animals down to the smaller animals. So typically energy flows up in a system, but when ticks feed on something as big as, say, a deer and then get eaten by a much smaller organism like a bird, it's one of the few places where energy flows from deer to birds via the tick. And the more places you have for energy to move throughout a system, the more robust that system is. It just keeps things healthier overall.
Yeah, it's kind of like mosquitoes and all of the annoying things that we consider pests, right? We're like, do we really need them? And the answer is almost always, and maybe always, yes.
They're at least useful. They keep the system running, which is good. I mean, possums, one of my favorite creatures of all time. Possums eat like 95% of the ticks that land on them or like attach to them. And ecologists think that they don't stop ticks from attaching because they know that an attached tick is an easy to eat tick. So rather than having to like snuffle around in the leaf litter to find ticks to eat, they just wait till they come to them. Dang. And then it's like these free calories and they eat them before, you know, they like eat a bunch of blood or whatever. But
that's crazy.
Wild, right? Yeah.
So hardcore possums.
Yeah, possums are hardcore. Apparently squirrels and chipmunks do that too, but I think possums should get the credit.
Huh. Who knew? So moving into kind of what we've got going on this week and how it relates to our episode last week. Last week, obviously, as you know, we talked all about gopher tortoises and the different pressures they face. One of those pressures is human pressure, right? So we have like people moving in from all sides, essentially.
Because people love the beach. I mean, it's what we're here doing this week, right?
Yep. Definitely. So we're really reducing that habitable space that the gopher tortoises have to live in. So as we talked about in last week's show, that's something that's kind of being studied and researched, and how are they adapting to meet those changing pressures. This week, we also kind of talk about human pressures on a really interesting animal. What are we talking about this week, Chance?
This week, we are talking about whales. What specific type of whale, Sarah Catherine?
North Atlantic right whales. They are the state marine mammal of Georgia. But they also face these human pressures, right? So of course we have like pollution in the ocean, lobster traps, crab traps, these things, different types of fishing line that the whales can get kind of tangled up in, which you see often. And you also pretty often see boat strikes as well.
Yeah. So literally the two biggest threats right now to the North Atlantic right whale are getting tangled up in fishing line, fishing gear in general, and getting hit by boats. Those are causing a lot of mortalities.
And you will definitely hear more about kind of what's happening with all of those pressures that they're facing and how they're adapting to that in this upcoming episode.
Yeah, it was a really kind of a cool like primer on whale biology in general. You know, Kathy's just brilliant. She has so much information to give and really like an update on the population status for North Atlantic right whales in general. So Sarah Catherine, I have prepared for you this week a small quiz to see if can identify a North Atlantic right whale.
Oh, man.
I'll tell you this. I would have failed. Oh. This is not something that I would have known very well. Okay, so let me pull this up.
Okay.
So I have four pictures of whales.
Okay.
Or illustrations from the NOAA website.
Okay.
I'll tell you that there's a bowhead whale, a humpback whale, a gray whale, and a North Atlantic right whale. Your job is to tell me which of these pictures has the North Atlantic right whale.
Okay.
So here's one.
Okay. Picture one.
Picture two.
Okay.
Picture three.
Uh-huh.
Picture four.
I'm going to go with picture one.
You think picture one is the North Atlantic right whale?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you identify any of the others?
The humpback whale?
Picture two was the humpback whale.
Wait, maybe this is the right whale.
Ooh, you found it. That's absolutely right.
I was like, maybe the first one is the bowhead whale.
That's exactly right.
Sweet.
Wow, so you really did. You got them all right. So the first one was the bowhead whale. The second was the humpback.
Mm-hmm.
Third was the North Atlantic right whale with that giant smile.
Yeah.
And then the last one was the gray whale.
Well, I knew with like, so we talk about baleen in this episode, and I feel like this, the baleen in that picture of the North Atlantic right whale, I was like, okay, maybe it's this one.
It's kind of aggressive.
It's the only one with that big smile.
Yep. And they all have baleen, but that North Atlantic right whale.
He was showing it off.
Yeah, definitely showing it off. Very good. I'm very impressed with you as a previous marine mammalologist. You did good.
That was a fun little surprise.
I thought you might enjoy that.
So if you're listening and you want to play along with that awesome game that Chance prepared for me, you can head to our Instagram. We'll do a story with these four options and see how many you can get right. If you miss it, you can check out our highlights on Instagram and click through and find it there.
When was the last time you saw a whale? Like a big whale?
Well, I wish that I could say that I saw one when we were just on the Georgia coast. That's the dream. To see a North Atlantic right whale. I think that would be so cool while we were down there. But I think the last time I saw a whale, ooh, actually, if you've been listening for a long time, you may remember we've done a couple of podcast episodes like way back in like
2019,
I guess. Yeah, some episodes at something called Whale Fest that happens every year in Sitka, Alaska. The Sitka Sound Science Center puts it on up there. It's a really great community event. And the last time Chance and I were up there, they do these...
We got to go out on a whale watching tour, right?
Yeah. They do these whale watching tours every year. And we were out there and Chance was talking to one of the scientists there. And I was kind of like, I was in the conversation, but I was also kind of like looking around distracted as I typically am. And I saw a whale breach, which was like apparently, and everyone like gasped, and the scientist was like, oh, like what happened? And she
yeah,
was
we
like,
missed it.
Well, yeah, you two missed it. I saw it. And I was like, this whale just breached. And she was like, oh, wow, that's really uncommon for this time of year. I told everyone we wouldn't be seeing that, but some of us did.
Yeah, you just got to bring Sir Catherine along. She knows how to find cetaceans. Dolphins, whales, she'll spot them if you're by the water.
Yeah, I did an internship, ironically, in Wales, the country, as a marine mammal observer, essentially. So our job was literally to like do these marine mammal tours and like sit on the top of the boat and look out for dolphins, seals, puffins, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. That would be so cool.
I got some spotting expertise then. But also that made me think of, I don't know, I can't remember if it was the same trip or like the next trip or something.
Oh, the killer whales?
Yeah, we went on a hike and we just like briefly saw these killer whales, which was so cool because I've never seen killer whales in the wild.
Yeah, I think that was the same trip. I know it was Sitka, which, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that my only two times seeing like true whales in the wild were in Sitka, Alaska when we were at Whale Fest tracks. But yeah, I think it was, we were hiking in the Tongass Forest in Sitka and just like looked out across the water crossing and there were four or five dagger fins just popping up and down. It was so cool.
Yeah, it was crazy. We ran back and we were like, we saw this thing. Is this like actually what we saw? Because we had never seen them and they were there and then they were gone. Like we didn't, they were like rounding this bend where we were kind of like looking out. So
sort
we
of
only
a blink of the eye situation where it was like, did we really just see that? Was that Sasquatch?
Yeah, that was crazy. I forgot about that until just now.
Yeah, that was super cool.
Anyway, that leads us in to kind of a great whale focused episode. Let's get to the show.
We are very excited to be sitting down across the table with Kathy Sakis. She is a lifelong naturalist. She's an ocean science communicator, kind of a titan in the world of right whale biology, and has just stories to share. She graciously just made us lunch in her home as we've been sitting on this podcast trip, and I'm just really, really excited to be here with you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be with you all.
When I was finding someone to interview for our coastal conservation season, I obviously wanted to interview someone on North Atlantic right whales. I feel like that's an important story to tell when you're thinking of coastal conservation, especially on our Georgia coast. And so your name came up very often and very prominent. So I would love for you to just kind of give us the quick story of how you got interested in working specifically with whales and how you landed here with the positions that you've had with working with the North Atlantic right whales on the Georgia coast.
Well, that's a very easy question to answer.
Good.
I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and that was on Little St. Simon's Island back in January of 1981. Actually, I was there from about August of 79 to the end of 81, or maybe even to 82. Anyway, January 1981, there were very few people on the island. Actually, the only people on the island were the caretakers, and my former husband and I were there. And so I happened to be in the lodge. Now, if you can imagine, this was before cell phones. This was before Little St. Simon's Island even had a landline. So there were no phones, right? The only way that you could communicate was to go up to the kitchen, and there was a two-way radio. You could press the bar and talk. You could release the bar and listen. And so
different times back then.
Yeah, a little.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was no, there wasn't even electricity. The electricity line had not been laid yet from St. Simon's. So the way we had electricity was from a generator, you know, diesel generator. So that was noisy. And from about 10 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning, you had no electricity.
Yep.
So everything was off. The generator was off. So yeah, it was kind of interesting. But anyway, so in January of 1981, I was up in the lodge and a crackly message came across the radio phone. So I responded to it. It was the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard said, we are up on your north end. We just flew over your north end. You have a pygmy sperm whale up on your north end. Can you identify whales? And I said, why, yes, I can identify whales. They're kind of big, so they're easy to identify. Yeah. And he said, well, will you go ground truth that you actually have a pygmy sperm? And I said, sure. So I jumped in the Jeep, went up to the north end, and I started looking at this thing. And I was like, well, I've never seen this kind of whale before because A, it was definitely not a pygmy sperm because they have teeth. This thing had baleen, little teeny tiny little baleen plates. And further, it had an umbilical cord sticking out.
Oh, wow.
So this was a calf. And so I had to go back home, get my ID book, and I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, gosh, the only thing it could possibly be is a northern right whale. Now, back then, all the books said northern right whales. They didn't say North Atlantic right whale.
Right.
That would come later. Mm-hmm. So this thing had no dorsal fin. It was solid black. It had been already started being predated upon by birds. So the outer flesh was kind of chewed up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I, you know, gleefully went back to the kitchen and said, hailed the helicopter. They had told me what the call sign was for them. I hailed them and I said, this is Kathy Sackis on Little St. Simon's Island. I am here to tell you what the true identity of that whale is. Yes, ma'am, let's have it. And I said, well, it's a neonate, meaning newborn, calf of it's a northern right whale. And there was silence on the other end, and he goes, no ma'am, that's not right. And I said, well, it is right, I'm looking at it, you're not,
and you're much further away.
Yeah. So that turned out to be the first it was the first calf that we had seen. Now I think the Georgia DNR had seen an adult right whale, maybe like a couple of weeks beforehand. So that gets the first sighting. But my calf was provided the missing piece to the puzzle about where the North Atlantic right whale calving ground may be. So the New England Aquarium had been looking at right whales in the Bay of Fundy for decades. And they knew that half of the population or a portion of the population would leave in the fall, mm-hmm. and come back in the spring with calves.
Yeah.
But they did not know where they were going to birth those calves. So my little piece of the information provided that maybe this is where it is, which turns out to be
where it is.
That's exactly right.
And yeah. Whales are interesting because they undergo these seasonal migrations, very different from other animals, where they spend the warmer months up feeding up further north.
Yep.
And they come south for the colder months to give birth to calves.
That's correct.
And that's usually true across migratory whale species. But that makes it really hard before the advent of large data sets and, you know, cross-country communication on where these animals are and the tagging to know where they go when they disappear from your local study site. So this is kind of the piece of the puzzle that was coming in to figure out where they're going when they leave further up north. They're actually coming down here to our warmer, quote unquote, warmer waters in the winter down here in Georgia to give birth to these calves. And we're a really important part of the life history of this species is this calving process that happens here.
The critical thing is that, you know, mama has about a meter, you know, maybe a little less than 3 feet of blubber. So she's pretty well insulated. But when the baby is born, it's got just a smidgen of blubber. So mama can't go much further south. She'll be too hot. Baby can't go much further north. It'll be too cold. So it turns out that the coastal Georgia and northeastern Florida coast tends to be the happy medium for both mom and calf. So that's why we are so important, we meaning coastal Georgia, so important to this process. And it's quite wonderful that a group of, I think there were sixth graders from Tybee Maritime Academy, decided that the North Atlantic right whale should be the Georgia state marine mammal. And they made it happen.
And it is true. It is true. Georgia's state marine mammal now,
yep.
Which is awesome because, you know, we really are a very important part of that animal's life. And it's really such an awesome experience to get to see this. You know, there's not a huge population. I mean, you know, what are current estimates for the North Atlantic right whale population right now?
Right now, NOAA is saying 350.
But they've total.
Been, yeah, they've been saying that for a long time. So
yeah. And that's in comparison to historic numbers of North Atlantic right whales in this area. There were probably on the order of about I think it was 21,000 is what I was looking at for pre-whaling numbers of the North Atlantic right whale. So, I mean, a dramatic decrease in their population over the past couple of centuries because they were the right whale. That's why they're called right whales, is because they have that massive 3-foot blubber layer that means that they're going to float when they're dead. So if you're going out there and you're collecting whales for whale oil, which was, you know, kind of like kerosene today, where it's just the fuel that the world ran on was whale oil. The right whale floats, it stays at the surface, and it stays close to the coast. So you're not having to go way, way, way out into the middle of oceans to catch these whales. That's in large part why there was this massive decrease in population over the last 200 years, because there were the largest pressure from the whaling industry was on right whales, and especially North Atlantic right whales.
And they were the first to be hunted because they were so easy. So their numbers plummeted, very early on in the whaling industry. I mean, everybody assumed that the northern right whale was extinct. But I think it was in the 70s that the New England Aquarium realized that they had a population, and by then we were calling them North Atlantic right whales,
right,
to separate them from the, North Pacific and then the Southern right whales, which don't have Southern Pacific and Southern Atlantic. They're just the Southern right whale.
Yeah, there's some land masses in the Northern Hemisphere separate them. And then the other, going back to their thermal constraints, the Northern populations and the Southern populations are kept mostly separated because mm-hmm. the equatorial waters are so much warmer. Right? They don't like warm water. To go back to that, talk about their blubber layer, it's like wearing a down jacket, like a really heavy winter coat all the time. That serves you very well when you're in Antarctic waters. But as you get further and further north, that water warms up. And now all of a sudden you're wearing that same down jacket in the Amazon rainforest where it's hot, hot, hot. They're just a really interesting species that where they're located is really constrained by water temperatures.
They're Eubulinas, but the North Atlantic right whale is Eubulina glacialis, and the one in the southern waters is Eubulina australis. So they still the same genus, but separated species, even though if they were to get together, they probably could reproduce, mate, and then give off a reproductively viable offspring, which is the criteria right now anyway for what makes a species.
Right, absolutely.
So when did the work begin to try to help bring this population back? It's like, okay, we see them again, how can we help them? Because we obviously want them here. There are these huge marine mammals that have such an impact on our oceans and are so important to the oceans. So, and I know you specifically have been involved with a lot of the work to protect these animals. So what has kind of that process been, I guess, of, okay, what are the steps we can take to make sure we keep these animals around?
Well, so the history of where, how the conservation effort got going was, when my little calf was made known, then about a month later, another one washed up on Ossabaw Island. So now we have two calves that are confirming that this is indeed the calving grounds. The Georgia coast is indeed the calving grounds for the North Atlantic right whale. So very soon after that, now this was 1981, it was decided that we needed to have aerial surveys to do a systematic search to see how many whales were actually down here during the winter. So a group of retired Delta pilots decided to help out. The call was spread and they answered the call. They used their own airplanes and they would fly survey teams. So there would be the pilot, the lead, and then two observers in the back. There would be the recorder would be right with the pilot up front. And these survey teams eventually expanded to five different teams. And the teams went from Hilton Head, South Carolina, all the way down to Cape Canaveral. That was the length of the coast.
That's a pretty broad amount of ocean to be surveying.
Well, so these five teams chopped up they each had their own survey team. So I led one from Hilton Head and we flew down to Asaba Island. But the survey went like this. You go up from the airport, you fly 30 miles straight out, and then you fly 3 miles down, and then back to the coast. 3 miles down, 30 miles out, 3 miles down, back to the coast.
So you're doing this real grid work.
It's a grid, yep. And while you're doing that, you're flying at about 700 to 800 feet off the ocean surface. And it's amazing what you can identify. I was identifying tuna. Identified several sharks that you can see just at the surface. Turtles.
That's so cool.
That's amazing.
And the coolest thing I saw was about a pod, an offshore pod of bottlenose dolphins. There were about 200 in that pod.
Wow.
And it was one of those really rare calm days. I mean, it was like a glass surface to the water, and the dolphins were just leaping. I mean, they were leaping, and, you know, and then they would tail walk. And this was all, you know, these were not, to my knowledge, entertainment dolphins. Right. They were just doing this naturally.
They're natural behaviors. A lot of people don't really realize that a lot of what you see for cetaceans in human care are their natural behaviors that have just, they've been trained to present them when they're asked to present them.
Right.
Yeah. I remember when I was younger, I've always had a love for the ocean, but we went down maybe to like Mexico Beach or something and took out a jet ski, and these three or four dolphins just like came up and surrounded us, and we're like swimming under, and like they'd turn on their side so they can see us, and they were just like jumping out of the water, and we just like turned the jet ski off and like sat there. But it was just crazy to see. It's so cool when you get the opportunity to see something like that.
Now imagine there's 200 of them.
Oh, I can't even imagine. That's insane.
But they, you know, and they're freely doing this. They're not being asked.
Yeah.
You know, or rewarded.
Right. It's not like enticed. You're throwing them food from the plane, like, oh, right. Yay.
Yeah. So that was very cool. So we established that, you know, probably South Carolina, middle of South Carolina, was the northern range at that time. And then they would go all the way down to Cape Canaveral. Since then, because the ocean is warming, it's moving all the way up now to North Carolina. And moving further up from Cape Canaveral, it's shifting northwards,
right.
And that's to be expected with the ocean temperatures warming up.
So. And that's kind of the main thrust that I would like to have for the next couple of minutes that we get to spend together, is talking about the ways in which North Atlantic right whales specifically are responding to changing oceans. So. Mm-hmm. Across species in a lot of different ways, that as the Earth gets warmer, which it has done previously, just not nearly as quickly as is happening right now, which is really the problem, animals move towards the poles, or species in general move towards the poles, plants, animals, everything, because they're seeking temperatures that are like what they were experiencing before. So if the northern reaches of the ocean are warmer than they were, they're going to go further and further north until they find the colder waters.
And it's all related to temperature, but, you know, the feeding grounds are shifting too because of that. So that really nice upwelling of the krill and copepod, which is the preferred food for North Atlantic right whales, is shifting further northward. So the whales have to go further up to get that. And so these whales, when they're adults, they need about 4,000 pounds per day of krill and copepod to maintain their weight. Well, you figure they're 60 tons, right? You know, that's a whole lot of whale there.
It's really fat heavy. Body weight, right? Yeah. There's so much fat and lipids in that blubber layer.
Yeah.
That is just energetically expensive to maintain. It takes a lot of food to maintain that.
And so this comes into play with females becoming pregnant. A female has to maintain a certain percentage of body fat to even get pregnant, and then to carry that calf to full term, that fetus to full term. It's a 13-month gestation period. On top of that, they have to swim 2,000 miles you know, pregnant. Can you imagine being, you know, about ready to give birth? Oh, wait a minute. I got to now swim 2,000 miles.
Right.
Well, my God, that's a lot of energy expenditure.
Right.
And when they come down here, they don't feed. There's no krill and copepod down here for them to feed on. So they lose weight very rapidly. On top of that, then they have this calf. The calf is nursing. And the milk of a North Atlantic right whale is about 42% milk fat. Now, compare that to heavy cream. It's about the same. I mean, it's a little more than heavy cream, right? Hmm. And so the baby gains about 200 pounds a day.
Jeez.
For the first several days. You know, like maybe 10 days, it gains 200 pounds per day.
Jeez.
And wow. Then it starts to, you know, slack off, but or lessen. But, you know, you figure this is the strategy. This is the survival strategy that this species has developed over time, that, you know, we come down, we birth the baby, we fatten the baby up. We make sure that they're strong enough to then swim 2,000 miles with mama back to where she can start eating again.
And all of those calories have to be in her body
before
she begins this process, right? Because there is no calorie input once she leaves those food-rich waters of the north.
That's right.
She needs enough calories to get there. She needs enough calories to feed the baby so that its light windbreaker of a blubber layer turns into this downy jacket layer that is, you know, insulating enough to survive the cold waters in the north. And so not only is the warm waters in the south an issue where it's changing their birthing grounds, but as the copepods change their location because their waters are warming in the northern waters as well, the whales have to put more energy into foraging.
That's correct.
And they're finding, you know, if you have this really established diner and, you know that in this bay, there's a consistent source of calories that gets you enough. You don't have to spend time checking out new restaurants. But as the copepods change location, all of a sudden, on top of the energy expenditure to collect these calories, you're also adding this energy expenditure to find the restaurant again.
Yep.
And it changes year to year to year, or even throughout the season. And so it's just this other layer on top of this already massively energetically expensive endeavor that the mothers are going through.
It becomes very critical for this species, this population, to have that access to that rich, abundant food source. So what researchers have noticed that when they compare the body size of the North Atlantic right whale with the southern right whales are doing just fine. You know, they're maintaining their body weight, but our poor North Atlantic right whales are skinny, much skinnier and much shorter now than they used to be historically. So this is a result of, as you say, having to find that new restaurant.
Right.
You know,
right.
Search
Absolutely.
For it. Yeah.
It's interesting to me that we're having this massive effect on the northern populations and not seeing the same effect on the southern population. Although I guess they're... I don't know. Is it a difference in landmass and upwellings? Is it just a different convective current?
Currents. It's that currents have a lot to do with it. So, you know, we've got the Labrador current that comes down off of the northeastern United States, but also Canada, southeastern for Canada. And that Labrador current brings down the cold water. Well, that cold water sinks because it's denser and it creates the upwellings. And so that's where the krill and copepod are proliferating, because
tasty nutrients that were sitting on the bottom, you know, that used to be whales and other things, are being pushed up by these currents. And so it's this buffet for these you know, microorganisms, you know, smaller organisms that the whales are feeding on. So when those currents get interrupted, it breaks that food supply, or just changes where that food supply is. And it makes everybody have to work harder to find their food.
That's correct.
How long does the calf stay with mom?
Okay, that's a two-part question.
Okay.
Because, all right, so it nurses, the calf will nurse for, you know, a little over a year, but he or she will stay with mom for several years.
Okay.
So we've had North Atlantic right whales that come down, you know, pregnant and are getting ready to give birth, but here they've got youngsters from previous years. And it takes, it's a major hit on the mother's body. So she doesn't reproduce every year, maybe every fifth or sixth year.
Yeah.
It takes that long to for her to, you know, get back to where she can carry another 13-month
Yeah, absolutely. Baby. And do we expect to see, you know, you've talked a lot about like, okay, so they feed, they get all these calories, they come down, they give birth, they're like transferring those calories through their milk, and then they also have to travel back to their feeding grounds. Do we expect to see a change in how long, like in between having calves, that takes, since it's going to be harder to find those calories potentially?
Quite possibly. You know, I don't know that answer. I'm not doing that research, but that's a really good question. And I'm sure somebody is looking into that mm-hmm. because, you know, these whales only have a finite reproductive window.
Yeah.
You know, if they can get five or six calves out of one female, well, that's huge. This is called fecundity rate. So they have an extremely low fecundity rate, okay. which means that they're not, you know, they're not popping out babies
right.
enough to counteract the death rate, mm-hmm. the mortality rate.
You're right.
And so compounding the situation with the calorie intake is that these whales don't have a reverse. They don't swim backwards. They only swim forwards. And so now we've got the added gauntlet of fishing line, lobster line, lobster pot line usually is the culprit. And then we have ship strikes.
Right.
So we've got all of these compounding issues that really impact the fragile population numbers that we have right now. So anytime there is a death, and especially a death of a female, well, now you're really impacting the potential for this population to recover.
Mm-hmm. So kind of the story that I was reading about the North Atlantic right whale populations over since we figured out they were in Georgia in about the 80s to about 2010, 2012, was this great recovery where they went from about 50 individuals to about 400 individuals over those decades, which in large part was because the two big issues we were fighting was, like you were saying, entanglement in fishing nets and boat strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this big campaign of, we're going to set out areas that limit speed for boats and places that you can't place lobster traps during certain times of year when calves or mothers are coming through. And it really did a great job of reducing the mortalities that we were seeing, which even one or two calves per season that are saved makes a massive difference in, you know, a population of 50 animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this kind of turning point over the last 10 to 15 years with the right whale population where is instead of growing, we've seen about a 26% decline was the piece that from the literature that I was reading over the last 10 years, in large part because they're now struggling with these warmer waters like we've been talking about earlier. But the other piece of that, I think, may be that they're in different places at different times of year now. The legislation that we've put into place at like at this time of year when we see this, you have to protect the whales in this way. Well, the whales aren't there at that time anymore. They're in a different location. And so I just kind of wanted to get some of your thoughts on what does North Atlantic right whale conservation look like in a world of changing ocean waters?
So when I was a federal employee, I worked for NOAA, Grays Reef National Marine Sanctuary, and that sanctuary sits 20 miles off of the middle of the Georgia coast, and it happens to be in the calving grounds of the North Atlantic right whale. So as part of my job, I was the education coordinator to work with the other agencies, the other entities that were tasked with the conservation of the North Atlantic right whale. And so I worked in a group called, this is really a long name, it's the Southeastern Implementation Team for the Recovery of the North Atlantic Right Whale. Well, that's a really long acronym.
Yeah.
So we just called it the SEIT, Southeastern Implementation Team. That's all we called it.
Yeah.
So within that group, I became the head of the education and communications committee. And we would identify the audiences. And one of our first targets was the shipping industry. And we went to captains, the actual ship captains, and we gave them a book that stayed on there at the helm so that they could identify, you know, even the spray of a right whale looks like, you
right,
know,
it's
a
very
V.
Characteristic, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's that V-shaped spray instead of sort of more of a vertical thing.
Exactly. So we gave them tools, visuals that they could use to identify these whales and avoid collisions with them if they could see them. The other thing that happened was NOAA insisted on putting observers on some ships, especially the dredges that were working in the ports. And at one time, I forget when it was, but the port of Savannah was shut down for 3 days when a mother would not abandon her calf. The wow. calf would not move and the mother would not move. So for 3 days, I mean, it was unbelievable how many ships were stacked up trying to get out.
Right.
How many
that were trying to get in. You know, tens, maybe hundreds of thousands or more worth of commerce.
Millions.
That's not, you know, I mean, just insane amount of money that's not happening in those 3 days that the whale has shut down the port.
They're on strike.
Right. But that was the rule. That was the regulation, the law. And
that's amazing.
To the port of Savannah's credit, they abided by that rule, even though it was, you know, they were getting really nervous about,
yeah,
you
sure.
know, how long this was going to go on. So in our interaction with the ship captains and the, you know, the people that owned the maritime industry, nobody wanted to see a whale, you know, wrapped around their nose, the bowsprit that goes underwater. And, you know, when you see that, it's just horrible. And everybody feels horrible, you know, it's just so sad.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to characterize people in the maritime industry as like all businessmen and like they don't care. Those are people who love the ocean so much that they have dedicated their lives to being on it. Of course, it's going to be devastating to know that the ship that you're captaining or working on has just caused the death of this really cool endangered species.
Right. And so they were very happy to work with us. What happens with the aerial surveys that are still going on, whenever you see a whale, you have a device that you can, you know, aim it at the whale, and it gives you the latitude and longitude of where that whale is. And then you call it into something called, here's another big acronym, Jack's Facts. And Jack's Facts is at the Mayport Naval Station in Jacksonville. They had the communication network. So we would call in the latitude and longitude, and then they in turn would look to see where the shipping traffic was and the likelihood of a specific ship to be on the same trajectory, that there would be an intersection.
Right.
And so they would call that ship and say, you need to change your course.
Correct course.
You know, to avoid collision with this whale. Well, that was very effective. You know, that really worked, and that goes on to this day. The other thing that happened with avoiding collisions was right off of Cape Cod in Boston, Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary noticed that using their GIS that the shipping channel went right through the majority of where the right whales were feeding. So if they moved the shipping lane just 5 miles to the north, they would avoid something like 85%
of
the collisions. Yeah, this was huge. And so right away, NOAA adopted that and coordinated with the shipping industry out of the port of Boston. And everybody was like, sure, yeah, let's do it. We don't want to, you know, collide with these whales. This is something easy. And that was a win-win for
Absolutely.
Everybody.
But all of that relies on predictable behavior on the whale's part of knowing where they are and when they're going to be there.
Exactly.
And so as that changes, it just becomes more challenging for everybody who's all on board with conserving the, I mean, nobody is like, the whales don't matter. We all want to protect them. It just becomes harder and harder to do so when you can't predict where and when they're going to be.
And here is a new strategy. I teach biomimicry, among other things.
Oh.
And so
it's a really cool topic.
We could talk about that for hours.
But I teach at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And all of my students are non-science majors. These are industrial engineers, designers, architects, interior designers, you name it. But anyway, I have to teach them about nature. And they have to make a project designed on strategies in nature, right? Well, I'm also a co-founder for Ocean Exchange. And invariably, the big winners are the people that are biomimics. They have developed a product that is based on biomimicry. Last year's winner was a lady, and I cannot remember her name, I'm sorry, but but her product is called Remora. And Remora is a bioacoustic tag that uses the strategy of a remora to attach to a whale. And
wow.
Right whales in particular are very hard to tag because they have no dorsal fin. There's no,
there's nothing to stick something onto or attach
it
to.
Yeah. And so the only tags prior to this one have just been suction cups. And, we have tagged, meaning when I was working at Gray's Reef, we had whales that were tagged and we would follow them at night because we just wanted to see where they were going, how they were interacting with their calves. Well, the only problem is that calves are just like little puppies or little kittens. And, puppies and little kittens get on top of mama, right?
Mm.
Well, right whale calves get on top of mama too. The only place to attach a radio tag with a suction cup is right on that big, broad, flat back.
Yep.
And, baby just gets up on
it, knocks it right off.
Yeah. So we were only ever able to track for about 2 days was the maximum.
Man.
But now with this new technology that's coming out, it's a game changer because it'll be able to attach anywhere on the whale.
Wow.
You get it on there, it'll stick. And so
that's really cool. Will it transmit data for? Or are they actively transmitting, or do you get the data once it falls off?
I'm not sure how this one is going to go. I guess they could program it to do one of two things, but or maybe even multiple data
downloads.
Did
you say it was acoustic?
Yeah, it's an acoustic tag.
So, I mean, I guess my understanding of those is a lot of the times they're just kind of constantly transmitting, and you've got this separate receiver that is catching the data whenever it is, or whenever you're in the area. So you end up set up this like node of receivers that hears where they are.
Yeah, actually, I'm not exactly sure if it's an acoustic tag, but it may be just a tracking. It is a tracking tag, but somehow she's got to send a signal to a satellite, and then the satellite downloads the positions of this whale.
Yeah.
But it's a long lasting tag. It's not not just going to be for 2 days.
Well, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Remoras have been getting better at sticking to marine animals for hundreds of thousands of years. Every generation is hopefully a little bit better at it than they were the generation before. So to stand on the shoulders of giants, so to speak, of the remoras that have already done the engineering work makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that when I went to this last meeting for Ocean Exchange back in October of 23, I happened to sit at the same table with a representative from the Department of Defense, and we were discussing her presentation, and I was, I'm all about right whales, so I was like, oh man, we gotta, this is a great one. And he goes, no, we've already dumped millions into her program. And I said, you have? And I said, is any of it going to go to developing this tag for right whales? And he says, oh no, we're not interested in right whales. And I said, well, you mean to tell me that you're pumping millions into her piece of technology, and you're not going to earmark any for what she really wants to do? No, we're not. We're not interested in that. And I was like, well.
Wild. Wild.
Well. She won anyway. So she got the $100,000.
That's awesome.
To help develop for right whales.
That's amazing.
So it sounds like there's technology that's emerging.
Yes.
That is helping give us, the real issue that we're facing basically is that things are changing faster than we can legislate them to protect the whales. But it sounds like there's some technologies coming online that give us faster access to locational data that helps us to protect them from things like boat strikes in the future.
And the other piece of technology that is being developed in California, they applied to be considered for one of the $100,000 prizes for Ocean Exchange, but they didn't really need our little 100 grand. They were already millions, you know, down the pipeline. And what they're doing is developing this warning system to a ship's hull so that when it detects a whale, that it sends out an alarm, and then that hopefully will alert the whale to get out of the way. Yeah. So there's that too.
Wow. I was going to ask because, like, I don't know, I guess I've kind of always wondered, why don't whales get out of the way of the ships? I know the ships are moving very fast and it's not like something they've evolved to be aware of in their life histories, but like...
Yeah, so right whales, like most cetaceans, have what they call semi-hemispheric sleep. So the one side of the brain sleeps while the other side of the brain stays semi-alert. And so because right whales, you know, have so much blubber, they just float at the surface.
They're just straight lounging in a hammock.
Yeah.
Floating at the surface. Yeah. With putting in zero energy. You know, in the dolphin world, we call that logging.
Yes.
When they're just floating like a log at the surface and resting half of their brain at a time. So same, it seems to stem primarily from just like those large periods of, you know, restfulness that's happening where they're just not really aware of their surroundings.
Yeah, they're kind of in a state of stupor, you know, they're just not paying attention, you know.
Just zoned out.
Yeah, zoned out.
Yeah,
that's it.
Very interesting. Okay, and so having this alarm system that would be like, hey, ship approaching.
They're like, wake up.
Wake up, get out of the way.
The half of the brain that is still, you know, kind of passively taking in this information would wake the whale and get it aware enough to get out of the way of the ship. That's super cool.
Yeah. It is super cool. And, you know, it's this kind of technology and this kind of forward thinking that is going to help, you know, that we're still going to have ship strikes and we're still going to have entanglements. But and now recently we've had two calves chopped up by smaller boats. And so now
I saw that like this season, like within the last couple of weeks.
Yep. And so it's the ship speed 10 knots applies to 65 feet or longer. And so now NOAA is moving towards making that 35 feet and longer as the regulation. And that's temporal. So it's just during the calving season, which goes from mid-November to the end of March.
Yep. That's cool.
Is there a certain amount of time from like a time a whale is born to this age we see the like highest mortality, and we feel like once you get to this age like they're kind of okay, or is it just like constantly an issue?
It's constantly an issue because each whale is different. To me, the really horrible sight is when I see a pregnant female that is trailing, you know, 200 pounds of line. And it's just digging into her mouth, you know, she just can't get rid of it because she doesn't have the wherewithal to get rid of it. So, you know, people are trained up in the Northeast and in the Southeast, Southeastern Implementation Team, to disentangle whales. I was trained, but I'm an old lady now, so I don't go out and do that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know,
cold weather, cold water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything that listeners of the show or just anyone out there could like do to get involved to help with these issues or just even to raise awareness?
So the best thing that people can do is to become aware themselves, become aware of the issues. There's all sorts of legislation that is going on right now that could help protect the North Atlantic right whale. And so staying on top of that and being proactive in contacting your legislators at no matter at what level, whether it's state or federal, and letting your voice be known. You have to speak up for, you know, they can't speak for themselves, so we have to do it. And then supporting products that are help with the right whale. Now, again, I'm going to go back to my biomimicry, but, you know, have you ever picked up a lizard, an anole, and you pick it up by the tail and all of a sudden the lizard drops, but you're left holding the tail? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now that's biomimicry. We're taking that and we're looking at line that goes on, you know, nets or traps. And the way this works in a lizard, as long as the pull is straight and it's a constant pull, it stays intact. But as soon as there's a twist to it, it breaks apart. Mm. And that's what we're looking at with fishing gear that has that capability of, if it twists, if something gets entangled in it, and there's thrashing, which whales do, they thrash about, then that'll disconnect.
That's
what we're looking. Yeah,
that's great.
What we're looking at, and then another technique is to not even have any lines at all floating at the surface. Is just have the line on the bottom in the trap, and then using electronics or using Bluetooth, you go near a trap, you hit the button, and the thing the
walk
trap
to the surface.
Yep. Yep.
That's really cool.
That's very cool too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, I love to hear that there's so many people working on these technologies to protect this really endangered but very cool local species that we have here in Georgia and, throughout the Atlantic. But it's neat that we get to kind of claim them as our state animal and as part of their birthing grounds. And I just really appreciate the expertise that you brought to the show today.
Oh, well, thank you. I obviously, I'm a right whale fan. So it's and I will say one thing that the bones of the little calf that I discovered back in January of 1981, I fleshed those bones out with the help of quite a few other people. And so because it was a neonate calf, the bones had not ossified, so they had not properly
turned to
hardened
bone
up
yet,
yeah
right.
hard not hardened, so they were very brittle, and so the bones were sent out to, I think it may have been La Brea Tar Pits, it
oh,
was
wow.
sent out to some museum, some center out in California that knew how to stabilize these bones, and so they were impregnated with a stabilizing solution or compound, and then eventually those bones ended up at the Museum of Natural History at University of Georgia in Athens. And so I tracked them down because, in your retirement, people ask you to do a lot of things, right? And so I ended up becoming the chair of the Tybee Island Marine Science Foundation. And we were going to do a right whale exhibit. I wanted those bones. I wanted
yeah.
those bones back on the coast of Georgia, back in that beautiful new center that I helped raise $7.5 million to build. And so I contacted the curator of natural history up there, and he said, "No, we can't give you your bones back." And I said, "And why not?" And he said, "Because they're too valuable. Genetically, historically, we just can't let you have them. They're hermetically sealed and nobody's going to touch them." And he said, "But I'll make you an offer." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "I'll have the engineering department 3D copy them." Like, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll take it.
Deal.
So those bones are coming back as
cool.
3D printed.
Right.
And they will be on exhibit at the Tybee Island Marine Science Center very soon.
Wow, that's
awesome.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, and the baleen. And I preserved a chunk of the baleen, which the Science Center still has.
That's fantastic. Right. Hey, do you want to go to Tybee after this?
Next time we're down here.
Next time we're down here. Well, thank you again so much for being on the show with us, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you both. I appreciate the opportunity, Sarah Catherine and Chance. We really appreciate it.
Wow, what an interview.
So, what did we learn this week?
We learned a lot about right whales. I learned that they have 3 feet of blubber. I mean, like holding your arms out in front of you, 3 feet? That is so much fat between them and the outside world.
That's more than like half of my height.
Yeah, because you're a little short.
I'm like an average sized human.
You're an average height. You're a regular sized human, but you are definitely not twice the fat layer of an adult healthy right whale.
No, but you are, so.
True, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
What did you learn this week?
I thought it was crazy to hear that a newborn right whale calf can gain 200 pounds a day.
A day, yeah. Right?
That's just crazy. I mean,
that is an insane amount of weight for a single organism to put on every day.
But that's many calories.
Right? And then you compare that to like an adult that's foraging during feeding season is eating 4,000 pounds of krill a day, right?
Yeah.
It makes sense that there's this sort of like stock up on calories during a certain time of the year and then offload all those calories at the other time of year.
Yeah, it actually reminded me of a class we had the opportunity to co-teach while we were in Sitka, Alaska, kind of relating back to our conversation at the top of the episode.
About optimal foraging, right?
Yeah, exactly. So a different type of whale up there, obviously, but the same kind of thing is like they're spending so much energy to dive down and eat all of this food. It's not like us when we're like, you know, we go to the drive-thru and we're like, hey, I want this, and then we eat it. It's like us running a marathon to get a cheeseburger or something every time we want something to eat.
Right. What they were looking at in Sitka is they have salmon hatcheries, right? Alaskan salmon is a big industry. So the amount of salmon that you can catch is kind of tied to the amount of salmon eggs that we grow and release out into the wild each year. Well, humpback whales, which are foraging in that area, have learned that if you hang out by a salmon hatchery, when they release all of their little baby salmons to go out and grow into adults, you can catch like 70% of them in a couple of gulps of water. And that is a massive amount of calories. And so we did this class where they were looking at, do salmon have more calories per gram than other types of fish? And if so, it makes sense that humpbacks are going to focus particularly on those food sources, because at the end of the day, every organism wants to do the least amount of work for the most amount of calories, right? If you have to run a mile, at the end of that mile, you'd rather have a cheeseburger than a salad, because if you're doing the same amount of work, you want more calories for that same amount of work.
Yeah, definitely. Something else really interesting that we learned during that trip was that these whales, when they were trying to catch salmon that were in these nets out in the ocean, as they were being released, they would make what was called a bubble net. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
So they would like go around and like create bubbles. Like they would blow out of their blowhole in a circle.
That makes this wall of bubbles that the fish are not going to swim through.
Exactly.
And so they're using just like their exhalation, their breathing out, to corral all of these baby fish into one conveniently mouth-sized area and then swallowing them all up in one big gulp.
Yeah. It's honestly kind of crazy to see. Animals are really smart.
Yep. And if you're interested in whales and the evolution of whales, I have to recommend a book. It's called Spying on Whales by Nick. I think it's Pynson. It's P-Y-E-N-S-O-N. But it is a fantastic book written about understanding whales and their evolutionary history over the last probably about 35 million years. I don't know if you know this, Sarah Catherine, but until very recently, geologically speaking, whales were not giants. I mean, they were like the size of big dolphins, maybe, but we didn't have any of the like 60-foot long massive whales until relatively recently. And it kind of talks about why that happened, which I don't have the time to go into right now. But
yeah. Well, I've definitely seen like the little graphics on Instagram where it shows basically this dog or horse-sized creature like slowly evolving into what we have as whales. But yeah, like evolution's crazy, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really interesting story in like what the different constraints on the species were to get them to go from a regular size to a massive size. And one of the things that I really liked about this interview is that we were talking about the whales and their health, but we also tied that to their environment, right? The warming waters and the changing habits of the copepods that they feed on and how that relates to the whales themselves. And that actually kind of dovetails really well with our next episode, which is all about oysters. Oysters are this really important sort of keystone species that build an ecosystem. They provide the structure that sort of defines a lot of these coastal habitats.
Yeah, oysters are a really interesting topic because they do so much in an ecosystem. Like they provide structure, they filter the water.
They mitigate like wind and wave action.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like they're a barrier for like during hurricanes and all of that. They kind of similar to mangroves and stuff.
Right. They're like animal mangroves, right? You know, they're technically animals, they're mollusks, but they do that same job of providing structure and a place for baby fish to hide and all of these really important aspects that are critical to an environment.
Yeah. And they also have this economic value, right?
Yeah, I love oysters personally. Like, I can't get enough of them.
He had an oyster po' boy while we were here at the beach.
It's if I'm going to somewhere that I can get fresh oysters, I will be getting as many as I can afford, which just goes to show that this is a species that is really valuable in terms of its environmental aspect, but also valuable, literally monetarily valuable to the economy of the states where it's found.
Yeah. Definitely. So, speaking of oysters, that will be next week's episode. We interview Justin Manley from the UGA Marine Extension. He was just really fun to hang out with, and he took us around their lab, and they weren't really doing anything with oysters right now. They were just about to start, I think, in maybe the beginning or middle of May.
Well, he had some that he was growing out, but they weren't like to the point where you could go put them out into the waters yet and grow them.
Yeah. So we got to see some really cool stuff.
We took the most sciencey picture that I think I've ever taken of like you and me and him standing in their grow out lab. And it's got like Erlenmeyer flasks full of green glowing liquids and like.
Yeah. Well, I think it probably helps too that, you know, algae and stuff is typically like a green and brown. So like when you have it in a scientific flask and it's also lit like from underneath, like it looks very like evil scientist lab kind of thing.
It literally looked like a movie set. It was super cool. But yeah, it was a super fun conversation about the state of Georgia's oysters, which are doing really, really well. And we kind of talk about why. But yeah, it was a really cool conversation that we got to have with Justin.
On to a few other notes. We have a fun new game we've been playing on Instagram where our friends and fans tag us in stories of weird things that they find or just things that they don't know what it is. And they say, Chance, what is this? This week, we had someone send us a video of a great blue heron.
Which are so cool and our unofficial mascot for the podcast.
Yes, when we see one, we like to say, hey, Ron.
Hey, Ron.
So, yeah, if you see something that you don't know what it is, or you're just curious to learn more about it, tag us on Instagram and say, Chance, what is this? And we will do our darndest to respond to you.
And it's super useful if you can tell me where you were when you found it, because like species on the East Coast are different from the West Coast. And like, just tell me where you are. I'll do my best.
Yeah. On another note, we got another review on Apple Podcasts.
It was so sweet.
It was so sweet. Thank you so much, Megan, for leaving us a 5-star review on Apple, as well as writing out a review. It's always really fun to see what people think of the show, but also honestly really helpful. Megan said specifically she likes this kind of back and forth chat that we've been doing on the open and closing of the show. So it helps us to see what you guys like, what you don't like, what we can do better, what you want to hear more of. So keep it coming. We love to see it and we really appreciate it.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're a nonprofit, right? I mean, we're literally a 501c3 org. Our goal is to work for the public good. If you're listening, I want to hear your ideas about what you want to know, what questions you have, all that sort of stuff. So you can find us on our social media. If you have the Spotify app, we usually do polls or open-ended questions at the end of each episode that you can respond to. We want to hear from you. Reviews are awesome.
So on that note, that's pretty much all we have for this week. And we cannot wait for you to join us next week for our oyster episode.